Seldom is anyone who has to introduce a person embarrassed by so many riches as these, both in the number of people who wish to hear the speaker and in the opportunities of introducing the speaker. It's very difficult to decide exactly how one does introduce Mr. Huxley. It's easy to start off by talking about his relationship with English literature, his family background as the grandson of T.H. Huxley, the great popularizer of Darwin, or the great-grandson of the great master of Rugby, Dr. Arnold. Or one can work out from a who's who listing of novels of a life which has perhaps remained more productive and more alive over a longer period of time than almost any writer in history. I was thinking last night that I think it can literally be said that with one novel, Brave New World, Mr. Huxley has been read by more college students in America than any writer except Shakespeare. Always through this long period of writing, he has maintained a very clear position of the limitations of society, of the views of men and their results, and yet at the same time always an element of hope of the potentialities of man. The perhaps despairing note of many of his works, especially in Brave New World, is that so many people want it to happen that it is more likely to happen than some of the prophecies like 1984. And I think it's true that, as Mr. Huxley has said in Brave New World Revisited, that the major flaw of Brave New World is that he put the fulfillment of it 6 centuries ahead. It looks as if it might be achieved much sooner. Since 1940, of course, he has become very much interested in mysticism, the possibilities of mysticism in human experience. And perhaps many of you have read the experiment which he himself made with the drug mescaline in the book Doors of Perception, in which an experience resulted which was similar to that shown in the paintings of Vermeer and Van Gogh. It seems to me a remarkable circumstance that on this day we should have a person who has been such a great critic of human foibles and weaknesses, a critic of society, and yet a person who is interested in the potentialities of man. I doubt if a more appropriate day than December the 7th could have been picked. Mr. Aldous Huxley on the possibilities of man.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me begin by a quotation from Ophelia, who in her madness brings out a remark which is extremely profound. She suddenly says, "We know what we are, but we know not what we may be." And this lecture this afternoon is going to be about what we may be. And of course, what we may be, as we all know from a study of history and from reading the newspapers, is something extremely different from what we are. For what we are, what we think we are, is in fact what we are conditioned to imagine and behave that we are. It is the persona which we put on. And what we may be is an enormous field of potentialities, both for evil and for good. We may be something absolutely monstrous, as was revealed during the Hitler regime, or we may be something devoted and heroic and self-sacrificing. And one of the paradoxes of human life is that we may be both at once. I mean, we may be extremely devoted and self-sacrificing in relation to our own group, and monstrous and hideously wicked in regard to other groups. So that, as we see, there is an immense field of of dark potentiality lying around this small illuminated patch which we regard as our personal self at this present time, which is the product of our conditioning and of our culture. Now, what I want to talk about today is what can be done in the way of realizing man's desirable potentialities, and what can be done in the way of not realizing the undesirable ones. Well, now, I would list the desirable potentialities of man more or less as follows. I would say that it is desirable that we should realize our potentialities for intelligence, and using the distinction made by Jacques Barzin, for intellect, the difference between the two being that the intelligence is this sort of natural first-order experience, which is on the lower end we share with the animals, and at the upper end we share with the mystics and seers. And intellect is the kind of intelligence which is conditioned by our culture and mediated through language and other symbol systems. How can we become then more intelligent and more full of effective logical intellect? How can we improve our capacity for creativity, for what in the past used to be called receiving inspiration? How can we improve our enjoyment and become more happy? And how, finally, can we become more capable of love and compassion and tolerance of other human beings? These are the kinds of potentialities which seem to me the ones which we would all self-evidently regard as desirable. And the problem is, how can we get them to be actualized? Nothing is easier than to enunciate high ideals, but few things are more difficult than to imagine the means whereby those ideals can be implemented. And this is a problem which has intrigued me for many years, which I've been working on recently in writing a kind of counterpart to Brave New World in the form of a kind of positive utopia, where I've attempted to think out, imagine some of the things which would have to be done if we want to actualize our desirable potentialities. Well, man is an exceedingly complicated creature, and it is quite clear that to achieve anything, we must attack on a great many fronts at once. With regard to some of these fronts, I can say very little indeed. There just isn't time, and some of the methods which would be used are, for the moment at any rate, out of reach and out of the question. There is, for example, the whole genetic method of eugenics. It's perfectly clear that the human race could improve its general standard of intelligence and intellect by judicious eugenic selection. And however, at the present time, it is also quite clear that this is not a matter of practical politics. However, I do think that so long as the world is divided into competing blocks, I think it is pretty clear that eugenics will probably enter into the political picture fairly soon, seeing that it is obvious that that society which first adopts a limited eugenic program aimed at increasing the number of people with very high IQs is going to succeed in the competition. I think this is one of the prophecies which I'm prepared to make, that within the next 25 years, this may become a very serious political question, that we shall find that in certain totalitarian states that this eugenic program has been adopted with a long-range view of increasing the level of intelligence, and that the democratic states, however they may dislike it, may find themselves compelled to follow suit. However, this is something which I do not propose at the present time to discuss, because it takes us too far afield. The What I shall propose to do then is to discuss the possibilities of increasing, of realizing potentialities on other than the genetic level, on the level of changing environment and acting directly upon the individual by means of education. Well, now, before we go any further, let us try to analyze what, in fact, a human being is. I would call a human being a multiple amphibian. He is a creature who inhabits simultaneously several quite distinct and, in a certain sense, incommensurable universes. He inhabits, first of all, the universe of chemical and electrical events, which are going on inside his body and by which his body is related to the external universe. He inhabits next the universe of what may be called first-order experience, a more or less immediate experience, not much conceptualized. And finally, he inhabits the universe of symbols, mainly of language. All the time we are living in these three distinct worlds. Let us give a simple example. Somebody sits at the piano playing and singing a hymn tune. Now, what is happening here? Obviously, the most complicated kinds of electrochemical events are going on inside the muscles of his hands, the muscles of his throat while he's singing. He, at the same time, is aware of the symbols on the printed page on the piano rest in front of him, the musical symbols and the printed symbols of the words. And he is aware of a first-order experience of the music, the tones of the music, the tones of his own voice, his feelings of his own body. And he's aware at the same time of the elaborate theological system which the words of the hymn refer to, so that we see that in practically all of our, in fact, in every experience of our life, we are always involved in these this world of multiple amphibiousness. We, whether we like it or not, we live in these different worlds, and it's quite clear that any attempt to realize desirable potentialities must involve action on all these worlds at once. What may be called the original sin of the intellect is the sin of oversimplification, the belief that any complex human event has only one cause and that there is one panacea for any given difficult situation. Well, this is perfectly untrue. We have to think in terms of multiple causation, and we have to think in terms of action on many fronts simultaneously. This is what makes the human problem so extraordinarily difficult. It is not simple, it is extremely complex, and it requires thinking, as I say, on several levels at once if we are to solve our problems. Well, now let us deal with these different aspects of the world. On the electrochemical level, I need say very little. It's quite clear that we can do something on this level by means of rational diet, by medical means, by means of a healthy regimen, and so on. I don't have to go into those details. Those are pretty obvious, that this is a way in which we can keep our electrochemical relationships with the universe on a satisfactory level, and that if we don't keep them on a satisfactory level, then everything else will go wrong and we shall not be able to realize our desirable potentialities to the full. I don't have to go into that any further. Well, then there is the question of doing something better than we do now on the level of symbols, on the level of language. Now here, if we go back over the history of education, the past and present, we see that almost all education has been predominantly on the linguistic level, on the symbolic level. The seven liberal arts in the medieval curriculum were all except for music and astronomy, purely verbal. And even the art of music in the Middle Ages was treated less as an aesthetic than as a scientific study. And of course, astronomy told fortunes and was connected with theology in a very close way, and was again not a very true example of a non-symbolic, non-verbal science. And in general, we may say that all our education has been, and to a very considerable extent remains, education on the symbolic and verbal level. Now, that the methods of this kind of verbal education, that they can be improved, is certain. A great deal of thought is being given to the subject at present, and anybody who wants to know what is being done in this field can consult Professor Bruner's book, The Process of Education, or Professor Skinner's work on teaching machines. I think there is no question at all that the methods which have been used traditionally can be greatly modified and, I think, improved so as to increase the capacity of the human being to use his language-centered intelligence in a more effective manner. I'm always slightly appalled when I see how children are educated now to find that in many cases the methods seem to be just as imbecile as they were when I was a child. And in some respects they seem to be slightly more imbecile. I mean, some of the methods of teaching reading seem to have retreated from the alphabet to the hieroglyph and to have gone back to a period before 1500 BC, when that remarkable invention, the ABC, was brought into existence. However, be that as it may, there seems to be no doubt that we can very distinctly improve our methods of education on the verbal level. Now, there are also, I think, methods, highly unconventional methods, which could certainly be used to increase the efficiency of teaching. I was struck the other day by reading in the journal of the American Journal of Clinical Hypnosis a short article on the use of hypnosis in teaching people to do problems in calculus. And this was an interesting article, and it's been confirmed by many other people in other parts of the world, that it is possible by hypnotic methods to give suggestions and motivations to people. In this particular case, what was done was to give suggestions which enabled the student to perform in 20 minutes calculus problems, which would have taken him at least 2 hours to do on a normal level, and to perform them with ease and with pleasure. Well, if we can do this, well, why shouldn't we do it? I think anybody who is subjected to education will see that this is an extremely useful territory to explore. And in this same field, we can take, I think, some interesting hints from Professor Esterbrook of Colgate University, who has written of the possibility of using another hypnotic technique, the technique of time distortion in the field of education. Here, quite extraordinary things can be done. Not at the present moment, probably only about one person, adult in five, can be hypnotized to the depth requiring time distortion. But in those who can be so hypnotized, it is possible to perform tasks in, say, 1 minute, which would normally take 30 or 40 minutes. You can get people to feel as though they were living through a span of an hour, and in fact, in clock time, to be living only in a span of 2 minutes or a minute. And there is quite a lot of evidence to the fact that you can, in this extraordinary telescope time, get people to do things which would normally take them the 2 hours in this incredibly short space of time. And this, of course, relates to some very curious psychological facts which show themselves spontaneously. The fact, for example, that every now and then we come across what are called calculating boys or idiot savants, these adults who are able to perform fantastic calculations in their heads in a very, very short space of time, which has led ethologists such as Conrad Lorenz to postulate the existence in the brain of a kind of calculating machine, like an electronic machine, which we can, in certain circumstances, get hold of. It doesn't have the power of judgment and reason. I mean, this is evidently why, on an evolutionary explanation, why we don't use this all the time. It works too fast for us to be able to use our judgment and our reason. But for certain purposes, it would be extraordinarily useful if we could tap this amazing ability. There's evidently a great deal of truth in all the old stories that when men are drowning, they pass through a review of their lives in a few seconds. There is, our nervous system does evidently have this capacity, and under hypnosis, it is to some extent under our control. Here again, as I say, there's seems to me a large field which could very profitably be employed and be explored and possibly used for the purposes of improving our capacities in the field of common or garden education. Now, so much for education on the verbal and symbolic level. I could, of course, say a great deal more about it, but I think it's more interesting to pass now to the problem of education on the non-verbal level, which is that side of education, that side of the training of the human being, which at present is most neglected, and which I'm quite sure could yield extraordinary results if we paid proper attention to it. What can we do here? What can be done to train the mind-body on its own level of immediate experience? There is a very remarkable phrase in Spinoza where he says, "Teach the body to become capable of many things. In this way, you will help yourself to perfect the mind and to come to the intellectual love of God." This is a very remarkable statement to be made by a philosopher who are generally rather uninterested in the body. But it remains, I think, profoundly true that if we substitute for the word body the word psychophysical organism, it represents a complete program of action, that we should train the psychophysical organism, the thing which has to do the learning and the living, much more systematically and effectively than we train it at present. And here, it seems to me, is one of the weaknesses of current education. For I had the privilege of spending 2 months last year at MIT, which of course is one of the newest of the scientific universities, and where they are very concerned about the problem of scientific specialization. How is this to be tempered? How are engineers and chemists and physicists to be made aware of something else besides their own speciality? And the answer given there, and of course given in other technical schools, is to give courses in the humanities, which is excellent. I'm entirely for these courses in philosophy and history and literature and the social sciences. But I think we must remember that this is not sufficient. What we are doing, if you analyze it down, what we are doing here is to temper the bad effects of one system of specialization on the symbolic level with another system of specializations, also on the symbolic level, on the verbal level. And what we need is a tempering of both these kinds of specialization by a training on the non-symbolic, the non-verbal level. And what does this involve? And this involves, I think, a training in general awareness of what is going on within and without us, a training on the inside and the awareness of the kinesthetic sense, a training in perception, a training in imagination, a training in all kinds of being conscious of motives and actions, which is something I think which our present education is sadly lacking in. Now, let me quickly go through some of these possibilities. On the level of training in the kinesthetic awareness, here we can appeal to the authority of John Dewey, which was considerable in the field of education, who spoke very, very warmly of the system devised by F.M. Alexander, who was an Australian who worked part of his life in this country and part of his life in England, who died a few years ago at the age of 85. And he spoke of Alexander's method of what he called creative conscious control as something which was to education what education was to life in general. Dewey himself had undertaken the training and was enthusiastic for it and regarded it as of immense importance in the whole moral and practical life of man, that this should be learned. And it is one of the tragedies that Dewey's enormous influence has been felt in many, many fields of education, not always, I think, for the best, but that in this particular field, no attention has been paid to him at all. In fact, I know of only one person working in any university in this country who has taken the trouble to acquaint himself with what Dewey was talking about and who is attempting to teach it. But here, as I say, there is a very important field lying open, ready to be explored. Now, from the field of kinesthetic experience, let us pass to the field of imagination. Here, as one sees with so many children and so many neurotics and psychotics, many people are the victims of their own imagination. This is an immense force in us, the imagination. The imagination is stronger than the will if we can harness it. It directs the will in a way which just mere efforts of clenching one's fists and one's teeth can never do. This was clearly realized, of course, by such great religious teachers as St. Ignatius Loyola, whose whole system of spiritual exercises was essentially a system of trained imagination by which he was able to get his Jesuit novices to steel themselves in discipline, in belief, in determination, in a quite extraordinary way. And of course, the same kind of disciplined imagination has been made use of in a number of the so-called new thought schools of religious science and whatnot, which simply are all methods of using the imagination for gaining specific success and gaining poise and effectiveness in life, all expressed in terms of a vague kind of theological language. But nevertheless, they remain essentially these exercises of the imagination, attempts to use this tremendous force that we carry about with us, to use it in such a way that it shall not damage us or not waste our energies, as happens so frequently, either when we have obsessive imaginary fears or when we lose our time in daydreaming, not, as I say, to in a negative way, but to use it positively for our own benefit and for the benefit of others. There is no question at all that if we really studied this problem of how to get children to use their imagination, we could do an enormous lot to improve the whole quality of living. And there are a number of people working in this field. I happened to read recently a book by which came from Australia on imagination games for children, which seemed to me full of the most sensible recipes for handling the problem of child education through the imagination, to using the imagination as an adjunct to the ordinary forms of teaching, and, as I say, harnessing this kind of Niagara Falls which we carry around in ourselves for the benefit of the individual and those around him, instead of in a wasteful or even a harmful way. Now, finally, we come to the question of awareness in general, and in particular of perception. Here again, it's very surprising to find that remarkably little is done to train the acuity or the discrimination of perception. We do a little in the field of music teaching. This is very important. We do a little in the field of art teaching. But a great deal more could be done, I think, to get people to perceive more clearly and more distinctly and more enjoyably than they do. One of the tragedies I always find is to find so many people who are bored with life. I mean, this world, heaven knows, is an alarming world, but it seems to be very difficult to think that it's a boring world, and yet a great many people find it so extremely boring that they have to spend about 8 hours a day in front of television. And it seems to me if they had learned to use their perceptions a little more acutely and discriminatingly than they have, than we present teach them to do, they would find even the commonest things in life a great deal more interesting than they find them at present. And it's a significant fact that what our ancestors called axidy in the Middle Ages was a deadly sin. It is generally translated as sloth, but it actually means being bored. In Dante's Inferno, the people who are being punished for axidy are inserted head downwards in a bog of mud, and their complaints come bubbling up like the noise of frogs through the mud, and this serves them right for having found the bright beauty of the day boring. Well, this is a deadly sin, there's no doubt at all about it, but it's not entirely their fault, because they've never been taught to use their perceptions as they could be taught to use them. And here I think there is a very important field open before us. Some work is being done, I'm glad to say, in this field by people like Professor Renshaw at the University of Ohio, but not nearly enough. And another interesting fact is that in the field of therapy this has been explored to some extent. There was a very successful Swiss therapist in the first years of the present century who died in the 1920s or 30s, who regularly treated neurosis by making people simply aware of what was going on in their bodies and outside. In a certain sense, all neurotics are people who do not live in present time, who respond to present challenges in terms of something which happened long ago in the past or is going to happen in the future. And any process which makes them aware of here and now is in itself a therapeutic process, and this was worked out by Vitos over the years, and as I say, he had a European reputation and did just as well, or if not better, than any other therapist of his time. And in more recent years, we've had a very valuable book called Gestalt Therapy, brought out by Drs. Pearls, Heffelein, and Goodman, which develops very much the same kind of theme and gives a great many exercises of the same nature to bring people back into present time. And it's very interesting to find that these modern techniques were anticipated several thousand years ago in some of the old Oriental texts. One can find, for example, tantric texts in the Buddhist and Hindu tradition, where an enormous number of exercises in pure awareness are given. Now, I can think of one text, for example, which is prefaced by a dialogue between the god Shiva and his wife, the goddess Parvati. And Parvati asks him, "What is the secret of your transcendental consciousness?" And he says, "Well, I will tell you how one gets there." And he proceeds to give her a list of 112 exercises in pure awareness, any six of which, if they were systematically practiced, would probably revolutionize most people's lives. But it's very interesting to find that in earlier civilizations, the necessity for obtaining this kind of awareness has been realized. It has been realized, of course, in all civilizations. Know thyself, gnoscite ipsum, has been the watchword of practically every seer and prophet. But the interesting thing is to find that there have been people who have not merely exhorted to awareness, but have given means whereby this kind of awareness can be achieved. Our great weakness, it seems to me, on the religious and philosophical level, is that we keep exhorting, we tell people to be good and to be intelligent, but we don't tell them how to be good and intelligent. And it's a great relief to find in, for example, such a text as I've been quoting, a really practical method whereby we can put into practice the advice which the oracle gave to Socrates and which he was never tired of passing on to his fellows, know thyself. Well, in relation to the value for creativity and in general for the good life of increased awareness, it seems to me that the best utterances are probably to be found not in the men of science or the philosophers, but in the artists and poets. I'm going to read now parts of two poems by Wordsworth in which the whole problem is set forth with the utmost clarity. These are two poems. One is called Expostulation and Reply, and the other is called The Tables Turned. And these, as I say, are a statement and a kind of program of what needs to be done in this non-verbal field. The poem begins, "Why, William, on that old grey stone, thus for the length of half a day, why, William, sit you thus alone and dream your time away? Where are your books, that light bequeathed to beings else forlorn and blind? Up, up, and and drink the spirit breathed by dead men to their kind. You look around, on your mother earth, as if she for no purpose bore you, as if you were her firstborn birth, and none had lived before you. One morning thus by Esthwaite Lake, when life was sweet, I knew not why, to me my good friend Matthew spake, and thus I made reply. The eye, it cannot choose but see. We cannot bid the ear be still. Our bodies feel where'er we be, against or with our will. Nor less I deem that there are powers which of themselves our minds impress, that we can feed this mind of ours with a wise passiveness. Think you, mid all this mighty sum of things forever speaking, that nothing of itself will come, and we must still be seeking? Then ask not wherefore, here alone, conversing as I may, I sit upon this old gray stone and dream my time away. In the companion poem, In the Tables Turn, it is William, the poet, who takes the offensive against Matthew, the scholarly man. And he begins by reproaching him for being a bookworm. And he says, "Books, 'tis a dull and endless strife. Come, hear the woodland linnet. How sweet his music. On my life there's more of wisdom in it. And hark how blithe the throstle sings. He too is no mean preacher. Come forth into the light of things. Let nature be your teacher. One impulse from a vernal wood can teach you more of man, of moral evil and of good, than all the sages can. Enough of science and of art. Close up those barren leaves. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives." Well, it's quite clear that both William and Matthew were right, that there has to be books, there have to be books, there have to be the study, there has to be study on the purely verbal level, there has to be an acquaintance with all that our culture has bequeathed to us. But that also, William is completely right, that there also has to be a wise passiveness, that we have to be purely receptive, that we must be able to look at things not projecting our concepts upon them, but look at them purely passively so that they come to us with all their inner significance. In practice, of course, it's entirely impossible for us to be absolutely receptive. We always project some certain amount of conceptualization upon the world, but it is certainly possible to be a great deal less conceptualizing than we normally are. And normally, we treat words not as though words stood for things, but as though things stood for words, as though every object we saw were merely a concrete illustration of some abstraction which we carry about inside our head. And it is necessary to get past this fatal habit of over-verbalizing, to get back to pure, inexpressible receptivity. And this is something which all artists, and again all religious people, have understood perfectly well. My old friend Roger Fry, the art critic, had a very good phrase for what Wordsworth calls wise passiveness. He used to speak of alert passivity as being the state in which the artist was when preparing himself to paint, or as the spectator of art, the listener to music, should be when he is looking and listening at a work of art. And this same conception of alert passivity runs through all the teachings of the great masters of the spiritual life. They all say the same thing, that in the words which are found in the Old Testament, "Be still and know that I am God." And one finds, a most striking example can be found in the correspondence between Saint François de Sales and his spiritual pupils, Saint Jean Chantal. And there's a very interesting passage where she writes to him saying that, how does she say, "In prayer, I always want to do something, but this is very wrong. By wishing to achieve something, I spoil everything." Now, this was precisely what Saint François had taught her, that she must come to prayer in a purely receptive state. And this, of course, was the great discovery, rediscovery of the Quakers in the silent services of the meeting house. This was to prepare by receptiveness for taking things in and then giving them out again. And this, of course, is the definition of genius. It is the capacity to receive, and then to receive passively, and then to give out with active hard work. I mean, the inspiration has to be balanced by activity. But activity alone is not enough, nor is inspiration alone enough. There has to be both. There has to be both William and Matthew. And in the words of the Gospel, there has to be both the way of Martha and the way of Mary. But these seem to be sufficiently self-evident truth, but yet it's extraordinary to what an extent we've forgotten this and how little we do to help children and in general young people or adults to live in a purely receptive relationship with things, which is just as necessary as to live in a conceptualizing and logical way. And here again, this is what I feel very strongly is lacking in our present training, and a great deal could be done systematically to teach people, to give them opportunities for this kind of receptive attitude, this wise passiveness in relation to life, which must be the complement of any active, conceptualized thinking. It is only by taking in that one can give out adequately, but a life devoted wholly to giving out, to imposing our patterns of thought upon the world, is a wholly inadequate life. I mean, it's quite clear that our patterns, however good, are only very faint and feeble reflections of the total pattern of the world as it's given. And that if we really take our homemade universe too seriously, we're bound to get into very serious trouble. And it is, as I say, only by cultivating this alert passivity that we shall, along with the other side of life, that we shall train ourselves in creativity and in enjoyment, both of which I think are very important, and in general awareness, which is one of the absolute goods. We don't have to justify awareness in terms of anything else. It is an absolute, that it is good to be aware, just as it is good to tell the truth or good to behave with a loving decency towards people, that awareness is one of the fundamental goods, and that anything that we do to increase awareness in the training of children and young people and of adults is an absolute good in itself. Well, finally, let's very briefly talk about the problem of actualizing the potentialities for love and compassion and general human decency. This is, of course, the most excruciating of all the problems confronting us. And I think, it seems to me, I may be wrong, but it seems to me that the recent advances in what is now called ethology, the study of animal behavior, make this problem seem even more difficult than it did in the past. It is not that, as the Victorian poet said, that nature is red in tooth and claw. This is not the real problem. Of course nature is red in tooth and claw, I mean, because we are all members of a food chain. I mean, we are eaten by somebody above and we eat somebody below. I mean, this is inevitable. And this is not the problem. But the problem which has arisen, of course, in the studies of animal behavior in recent years is that virtually all vertebrate animals and all the primates with whom we are closely associated show certain characteristics which are, as Nietzsche said, all too human. For example, all of them have this drive for what is called territory, for territoriality. They all insist on claiming certain areas for their own and of keeping out and fighting against all trespassers upon those areas. And where you get a gregarious group, such as a group of gregarious primates, such as baboons, they claim a social territory. And that they, or same thing is true of the howler monkeys in South America. They claim a certain territory in the trees, or the baboons claim it on the ground, and any other group of baboons or howlers which approach the borders of that territory are immediately set upon and driven off. And you have, I mean, the strange and rather terrifying picture is, as I say again, profoundly human, You have within these animal communities this ambivalence which you find in human societies. That is to say, a great friendliness and even self-sacrifice and devotion within the in-group, accompanied by passionate xenophobia and hostility towards all out-groups. What I said at the beginning, the potentialities for good and for evil are there present from the first in a sort of built-in way. And to what extent we've inherited this from our animal ancestors, I don't know. But the fact remains that our societies are much more like animal societies than was ever supposed in the past. It was supposed in the past that animal societies were dominated mainly by the sexual urge. But this is quite untrue. It is based on the fact that most studies of animal societies were made on animals in captivity, where they haven't got room for territory, and where they don't have and they don't have to bother about their food, so that they live exactly like the French upper classes before the revolution. Entirely for sexual stimulation. This doesn't happen to be the way that animals live in the outside world. They're tremendously preoccupied with questions of territory, also tremendously preoccupied with questions of status. The chickens have a pecking order. It's the same with the primates too. This goes right down this hierarchy, very often these preoccupations with territory or with status will actually override preoccupations with sex and even with self-preservation. I mean, these are extraordinary facts which have emerged and they've emerged only within the last, I think, 35 years. I think it's only 35 years since Elliot Howard established the fact of territoriality in birds, and since Murray's established it in the relation to primates, and since, in general, the studies of these types of animal behavior have really been systematically made. So that what I mean, what coming to, is that we find ourselves saddled, I think, with a number of built-in tendencies which have to be overcome by our teaching and moral ethical training in one way or another. Now, the problem is, of course, how are they to be overcome? How are we to overcome this kind of built-in xenophobia, this built-in hostility towards those outside the group? And how are we to transfer the tendency to devotion and self-sacrifice, which is very often witnessed within the in-group, to those outside? I mean, this, after all, is what Jesus was talking about in the Gospel. Love your enemies as well as your friends. Love the people outside your group as well as those within. The problem is, how do we do this? Well, the answer, I think, quite clearly is that there's no hope of just repressing or suppressing the aggressive and unpleasant tendencies. We somehow have to find ways in which they can express themselves, but express themselves in a harmless and, if possible, beneficent way. This William James raised the problem in his essay, The Moral Equivalence of War. The essay is not a very good essay. I mean, it's all right as far as it goes, but it doesn't go nearly far enough. The point is that it raises an extremely important problem and gives a kind of clue towards the direction in which it could be solved. It seems to me that we have to solve these problems in some way by admitting the fact of these generally antisocial drives and somehow giving them expression, but giving them expression in such a way that they shall not do harm and, if possibly, do some positive good. Well, this is a problem which, of course, every society has always faced. And here, I think, it's very important for us not to be ashamed of taking lessons from past and from existing primitive societies, past civilizations and earlier primitive societies and contemporary primitive societies. These people empirically worked out a number of extremely sensible devices. For example, let us take one device which has been described by Margaret Mead, the device of using the principles of Pavlovian conditioning to produce a friendly and loving attitude in the child towards other human beings and towards animals. Margaret Mead has described the Arapesh child, who is always, when it is being nursed by the mother, is not merely caressed, but is brought into physical contact with other human beings and with the local animals, the dogs and the pigs, which live in the villages along with the children. And this apparently, this is all carried out in the fully in accordance with Pavlovian ideals. And it works, which apparently is very remarkable. And it is very extraordinary that we have all the world religions and all great societies and civilizations in the past have stressed the importance of love and compassion, but it remains for this tiny society on the coast of New Guinea to work out really efficient methods for implementing this high ideal. Well, let us take a few hints from this. And similarly, on the moral, what James calls the moral equivalence of war, these have all been discovered in the past. I mean, the Greeks, for example, knew quite well that these violent and aggressive tendencies had somehow to be worked out physically, and they must not be suppressed, but let out in a harmless way. And for this purpose, they devised such things as the Menadism and the Corybantic dances and the Dionysiac orgies, all of which were extremely sensible and very effective ways of getting rid of these antisocial tendencies in harmless and even, since they were related with the current religion, in socially valuable ways. And it seems to me that we must learn from this. We tend now to rely on the most inefficient methods of moral teaching, which is exhortation, how many million sermons have been preached on saying be good, but look at the results. we have to find these practical methods, these moral equivalents, not only for war, but for in general, for these antisocial and antipersonal feelings which we have. And I can't go into details here because I don't know what should be done. All I can say is that we should certainly look very carefully into the current anthropology and into the history of earlier cultures to see what has been done in the past, and then attempt to work out in the context of modern life some equivalent for these things. It's only in such a way, it seems to me, can we find adequate methods for putting into practice these high ideals, which after all we've had for thousands of years, but unfortunately we have had the ideals without working out the means whereby they could be put into practice. And with this I will close. I hope I've left a few ideas in your mind. As I say, I don't know the answers, but I think I do know some of the questions, and if we can anyhow pose some of the questions, it may be that our collective intelligence will finally come up with adequate replies. Thank you.
We want to thank Mr. Huxley for this talk. It's rather pleasurable in a world in which optimists have turned pessimists to see one who has satired in the past see some chance for possibilities in the future.